Hello everyone and welcome to another episode of the Squawker Talker podcast. My name is Jake Entwistle and today we'll be talking about centre-backs shushing rival fans and goalkeepers performing miracles and blunders. And joining me on this Derby Day focus is chief writer at Squawker, Mohammed Butt. How are you, Mo?
I mean, I'm still recovering from yesterday with two absolutely... I mean, I'm very good, but I'm just tired, blown away, mate.
I'll give you an opportunity now to mention the player that you want to mention and then it will never be seen again.
Ousmane Dembele, 2.8 chances created from open play in La Liga this season. Only three players have high.
That was not as succinct as I thought it was going to be. I thought it was going to be more blowing away than that. But you might have heard him just then. And also joining me is chief editor at Squawker, Will Hall. How are you, Will?
Good. I'm in the mood to talk about football. What a Sunday.
You look surprised to hear your own name then as well.
Like, because you stalled on asking me how I was. I was like, was there going to be a question following that? What do I go off there?
No question. You go off the fact that you're on the talker and we're about to kick off straight away with the best derby of the weekend in terms of excitement.
Best game of the season maybe even as well.
There you go.
I would go so far to say.
Yeah, it's hard to argue with that.
We started off with a banger. And in case you did miss it, we're talking, of course, about Arsenal's 4-2 win against Spurs, in which Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang became the first player to score 10 goals this season. And bizarrely, he is matching exactly his form from last season. 31 shots, 10 goals in 2017 when he joined. 31 shots, 10 goals this season.
And the minutes are basically the same, right? So just over 1,000.
There's like 20 minutes difference. So is he going to win the Golden Boot? Is he a shoo-in for the Golden Boot?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think a lot of people did, but you and I definitely, we both backed him for the Golden Boot at the start of the season. And I think
he has to get that in.
Because it's the thing, isn't it?
He said that four times before we started recording.
Whatever Arsenal were going to do, it was always obvious this guy was going to score goals, and he's just continued to do so. And honestly, in a way that honestly seems more sustainable now as well.
I would disagree. He's having more shots from outside the box this season.
Well, that's true actually. But then remember all the tap-ins.
That counteracts the point about it. He scored two goals from outside the box this season, which is as many in his last 143 league games before. So
that's a stat. But look, all I'm saying is when he smacked that ball against Spurs, you're like, what are you doing? And then it went in. You're like, you're a genius, mate. Well done.
Yeah.
So it was just one of those, wasn't it? It was an amazing performance. He played well.
When Arsenal, he won five tackles almost on the pitch.
Yeah. When Arsenal were playing up and at him, like, came up flying out the blocks, it was like, this is perfect for him. This is why he's up front. This is the kind of game when Arsenal want to play him without Lacazette. This is the kind of game you have to play to get the best out of him. He's just played Dortmund football. He's just go flying at them. Unai Emery football, really. And just pressed them. And then his pace becomes not just an offensive weapon, but a defensive weapon as well. It's hard for centre-backs to set on the ball when he comes steaming at you, ready to tackle you.
I would say that in the first half, he was caught offside a lot, and also Vertonghen matched him really well. And it was the subs at half time that I think really unlocked him in that game, because Emery changed into that diamond and Lacazette and Aubameyang became both wingers sort of up front. It was like a false nine. And that's when we really saw the pace, when he moved onto that side and Lacazette and Aubameyang were causing havoc for Foyth and Vertonghen.
They wreaked havoc with Spurs' high line, which obviously sort of cost them for the third goal, the Lacazette one to go ahead. That was when Ramsey pounced on Foyth and was able to pass the ball forward and that put Lacazette bearing through on goal. I mean, I won't sit here
and Dyer deflected it in. Which was
Eric Dyer had quite an afternoon, didn't he?
Exactly. I was going to say it was the thing that he didn't want to happen after shushing the rival fans.
Ruckus. Also got mugged off for the fourth goal, but we'll discuss that later.
Okay, yeah, so I see what you mean actually there, because it's deflected in off Dyer, so it might not necessarily be the high line that's sort of to blame there. But
it was just funny how Dyer shushed the crowd at 1-1. And then it was him.
Oh, that's what you said. Yeah.
I'm not bashing your analysis.
He did not get the last laugh in that duel. But yeah, as you alluded to as well with Aubameyang, actually on the subject of the Golden Boot, so who would you say are his big contenders? Harry Kane, Raheem Sterling's obviously
Aguero
up there.
As well.
Aguero.
Well, they're the top scorers at the moment. Yeah.
They're rivals who are able.
Aguero is there every single season. Yeah.
They're rivals who will sustain a decent level of scoring over the.
Do you think Salah's going to be off the boil? Well, second worst conversion rate of any player to score 5 goals this season.
His finishing has not been as good as it was last season. We can say. So I think it's one of the most open Golden Boot races I can remember.
I mean,
I know last season was pretty close with Kane.
Is it open though?
I mean, Aubameyang.
Yes, definitely.
Is there a cluster?
Aubameyang has 32.3% shot conversion this season, which is the third of all players with 5+ goals. Like Glenn Murray. Incredibly, he has 41.2%. That's not sustainable, obviously. And Martial has 37.5%, which again is not sustainable because he had that run where he was just scoring with every shot on target.
Well, Aubameyang scored with his last 10 shots.
I was going to say Aubameyang had the same run.
I think this sustainable argument, you need to.
Well, I mean, let's
cool it a bit.
I mean, look, like you said, Aubameyang very consistent in these 1,000-minute blocks, right? So like, just plays just over. That was something that's falling down. Aubameyang's played just over 1,000 minutes, right? Had the same sort of production as he did last season, and he's done it again in his next 1,000 minutes if he can keep this up. And you've got to imagine, with no Europa League now to sort of be a midweek burden, you probably would wager he most likely can. And Arsenal kicking on, getting better under Emery. Torreira is now obviously a fully fledged starter, so it's balancing things.
Cool.
You know, you can only really see Arsenal getting better because this is the one thing I've said this before about Emery. So is they start off a bit ropey because like the tactical instructions he gives them there's a lot of them and it's a lot to absorb, and then by the second half of the season they just take off and they're really really good. So I
still haven't led at half time, and I would argue that in two of their recent home games, Liverpool and Spurs, were their best first halves respectively. So this Spurs first half, at least the first half of the first half, was the best Arsenal have played in the opening of a game.
It was
and
brilliant.
Yet they still... most goals from substitutes, 8. Most assists from substitutes, 7. Is that bad? Is that like something that needs to be addressed? Or is that just Emery showing that he knows exactly when to make a sub and isn't scared of doing it?
Generally speaking, I think you could maybe make the case that... there's an underlying statistical basis which you could sort of... forecast an end to their results based on the fact that their first half record is so poor. But I mean, I think just the fact that Emery's utilised the bench so well, and not only that, but has like sort of kept big players out of the team to be able to call on them from in later stages of the game, suggests that there's like a sort of a tactical
method.
Emphasis. Yeah, a method to the sort of perceived madness.
Yeah. They would be 19th if games finished at
I mean,
half, which is it's not just like they're better in the second half. Yeah.
It almost seems like a freak run as well. But coming back to Aubameyang, just to finish on that, the tackles stat, 5 tackles.
Yeah.
Ian Wright took part in a Ask Me Anything on Reddit just before that game, in which he singled Aubameyang out for his work rate, suggesting that, I mean, based on like how he takes care of himself, the amount of like energy he's got, you could see him like his career extend like well into his 30s.
Because he's 29 now.
That's an exciting prospect for Arsenal. Yeah, I would say so. The signing of Aubameyang in January was obviously met with like loads of hype, and it was a really exciting deal. But it didn't. I mean, that was the one thing about it, was that you were getting a Aubameyang who's like literally like the slap bang in the middle of his peak, rather than a sort of the best year, all the best years of Aubameyang's career. So that kind of dampened it a bit, and also obviously the fact that Arsenal were losing Alexis Sanchez.
Yeah,
but I mean, it's generally like. I mean, it's up there with Van Dijk in terms of transformative signings, you'd have to say, because of the output.
End of the pitch.
And I think as you discovered just before we came on the pod, and forgive me if you've already said this, but the Salah comparison thing, he scored as many goals as
Salah? Since Aubameyang joined now, he's... Him and Salah on 20 goals, and that's the most in the league. So,
and that was probably Salah's most productive half of the season.
Yeah,
that was.
I think that includes when he got 5 or 4 against Watford or whatever it was as well. So that's pretty good going. And Aubameyang is yet to score a hat trick as well. which is another thing.
That's always a good sign.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
You spread your goals out across them, they're more impactful.
Yeah. But just quickly on that game as well, and we've mentioned the bench. One player that has come off the bench numerous times to make a difference this season as well is Aaron Ramsey. He's got the joint most assists in the Premier League. And if he gets one more assist coming off the bench, he becomes the most prolific assister off the bench in Premier League history with 5 already. And we're only in December. So Ozil was left out of the squad for a back spasm, which is what Arsenal reported. Is it starting with Ramsey's impact and what he's done this season, Ozil's glimpses, is it... Did Arsene Wenger and Arsenal chase the wrong contract?
I don't think so. I think you look at Mesut Ozil and what he can give you and the quality he gives you. There's still so much there that no one else at Arsenal really has. And I think there are going to be games coming up. This is a long season. There's going to be games where they very much need Mesut Ozil and they miss him. And you know, this is the thing. And they turned it around yesterday and that was great. But it could just as easily have gone horribly wrong in the second half. And it might not have turned it around. And then you'd be like, oh, well, they missed Mesut Ozil. Imagine if they could have brought Ozil off the bench and so on and so forth. There are going to be games and situations where you need Ozil. I think Ramsey deserves a lot of credit for sort of, because it's clear the club are, if not forcing him out, then being like, you can leave, mate, we don't really care. And it's like, for knuckling down, just getting on with it and showing his actual qualities, I think there's a lot to be said for that. But ultimately, Ramsey is a kind of player, he's like 8 out of 10 at a lot of things. Nothing you'd say he's like 9 or 10 out of 10 at. And I think he's very good, but he's the kind of player who you could... if not one for one replace, but you could put, let's say, an Alex Iwobi or a...
Oh, I disagree.
You could give a young player a chance in his spot. And he might not be able to produce immediately because Ramsey is, what, 27? I think so. He's in his peak. But yeah, it's...
For the first time, the North London Derby, for the first time, was a team set up to play to Ramsey's strengths. And he came on and got 2 assists and like turned the game in 45 minutes.
Yeah.
Because the first time this season, again, Unai Emery, tactical flexibility. Arsenal played with a diamond at one point yesterday with 2 strikers up front. All of our previews at the start of the season, whether it was just a pipe dream, was like, just put Aubameyang and Lacazette up front together. And that's what they did. And they just split both centre-backs, played in between Sergio... Aubameyang played in between Sergio Aurier and the right centre-back. And when it was 3 at the back, just played on the left centre-back. And Ramsey just kept steaming through that middle, picking up all of... You've already mentioned, Will, when he... made the interception. He also picked up a loose ball to slide through. Knocked that pass onto Aubameyang for that curling effort and then got the sort of assist for Lacazette by winning the ball in that central area.
Yeah, it's a funny one because he's the perfect blend of aggression, intensity, and technical ability.
Which is Emery's...
Yeah, the perfect blend for most modern managers like Klopp, Emery, another one.
Mm.
Guardiola to an extent. I mean, he's got that sort of Wenger ball schooling throughout his career. I think you forget how potentially world class a talent he is, because the best parts of his career have just been stunted by like massive injuries. If you look back to the 2013-14 season, he was going to be player of the season had he not got injured halfway through, because his goal scoring output was so high for a midfielder. So, coming back to the question as to whether they awarded the contract to the wrong player,
because it looks like they're... I said it as that way because it looks like they were only prepared to give one person huge.
Yeah, of course, because that was the big Sanchez thing. Yeah. It looks that way, but it's massively... it's massively...
if we recorded this after...
With the benefit of hindsight...
If we recorded this after the Leicester game as well...
Because you'd have to say that the return from Mesut Ozil since signing that contract has been nowhere near value for money.
He's still created the most chances in the squad in the Premier League, which is what he's always top of. And one thing I would say is that... Is it a bad thing to have... Mo, you sort of alluded to it there. Is it bad to just have this sort of master key... in reserve, that when you don't play a team that, like Tottenham wanted to play against Arsenal and they were open, so Emery just used pace and people that could run off the ball, which Ozil doesn't do as well as Ramsey. But when you play teams like Leicester or teams that are deeper, you've got this... He might be a bit expensive, but it's like, oh,
it's
do we have a number 10 in reserve that we can just slip on for a magical pass? Yes, we do.
It's weird to think, because obviously he's been paid so much money and everything, but Ozil is a world-class creative player in that sense. There's very few players in the world that can create chances as regularly and consistently as he does. And I think not just not with good chances. He always puts his teammates in positions to take shots. Now, what Arsenal will discover, because they're going to keep doing what they did to Spurs, or do this to more teams this season, what they will discover is, as they get better, more teams will just, as you hit, yeah, they'll just park the bus. They'll just sit two lines of four in front of us. They go on and break us down, mate, if you're so smart. And that's when Mesut Ozil comes into play. I didn't mean to downplay what Ramsey can do. I've always been a big fan of his. He's very talented, but his kind of skills, he doesn't have this sort of, he's sort of jack of all trades, masters of none. And I think with that skill set, you can replace him with one or two young players and give them extra minutes. And it's easier to replace Aaron Ramsey than it is to replace Mesut Ozil, basically, is what I'm trying to say. There's very few players, can do what Mesut Ozil can do.
I just think Mesut Ozil, as a player, that you have to, from the head coach's point of view, is just so much more high maintenance, because you have to build the team around him.
Yeah.
Whereas Ramsey can come in and adapt. And I mean,
he's much more versatile.
Yeah, to refer to him as a jack of all trades, master of none, I know what you're saying. I don't think you're being disrespectful, so that's not the road I'm going down with this. But I think he's quite similar to a James Milner sort of peak years, in the sense that, like, yeah, he's kind of, well, he's a little bit better than a jack of all trades. He's kind of like
an Aaron of all trades.
He's proficient.
That's a new term.
I said he was very much, could potentially be Unai Emery's Ever Banega, and that's kind of what I mean. Is like, maybe jack of all trades is a bit harsh, but
Ever Banega
is the kind of all-around playmaker who can be very, very good at some things, but not necessarily excellent or world class. But he's just sort of really good at everything in terms of being a playmaker. And I think if you asked Emery, I think Emery would be like, well, I'd like to have him as well, please. I think he's quite good. But I think the board have decided that they don't want to renew. I don't think it's Emery's. I think Emery,
Emery's input has had input in this decision, because the reports I read after they revoked the contract suggested that he just wanted to reinvest that money elsewhere.
Yeah.
And the Mesut Ozil situation, without wanting to speculate too much on something that we don't have much information about, really, there does seem to be something funny about it. The manner in which he was dropped for the Bournemouth game, because Emery sort of looked at Bournemouth's style and play and decided it was a bit too intense for a player like Ozil to be in the starting lineup. And then at his response when asked about, like, oh, was Ozil watching the game? What's the situation? He said, oh, back spasm. I don't know if he's watching the game. Was a bit like, sort of, I mean, right, based in the context of, like, Ozil has had back issues before. His season was ended early last season, just after the Europa League semi-final defeat, by a back problems, a recurrence of a back issue, during which time Martin Keown on BT questioned his commitment to Arsenal, basically predicting that, I wouldn't be surprised if we see him out of the starting lineup for the rest of the season due to a sort of breakdown or something.
Yeah.
And then Ozil would subsequently go on to miss the rest of the games with his back issue. Then Mesut Ozil's agent came out and denied all this, was quite sort of strong in his comments against Keown. So obviously, like I say, we can't speculate, but despite my major speculation just then. But so this, what I'm driving at is this. So this is the context of this Mesut Ozil thing, and the reception of the news that Mesut Ozil was out of the squad for this was treated somewhat suspiciously on Twitter. There was definitely that sense, and for Emery just to come out and be quite vague in his comments about Ozil would imply to me that there is a bit more to the situation, because any manager who wanted to sort of quell all this speculation would have just said he's injured, and that's the sum of it, basically. And he basically could have quieted down this talk a bit more.
That's kind of
which
classic
makes the
Emery,
situation
though,
a bit interesting for me. And so,
it's definitely intriguing, and that's what I mean. It's like Wenger gave him the contract. He was Wenger's player. The song literally says he's Arsene Wenger's man. So he wanted to push that contract, give him the number 10 shirt this season. That was all done before Emery came in. And now the question is, if Emery had the choice of giving Ramsey a new contract of 300 grand a week and Mesut Ozil a contract of 300 grand a week, who would he choose?
Yeah, I think if you put it like
but
that,
but just like a quick, yeah, that's what I mean. I think he'd pick
Ramsey, because if Ramsey's up for Negro.
I mean, I still think Mesut Ozil, because as I said, like, this is all with the benefit of hindsight.
I think
you just have to, because of the.
But Mesut Ozil's older. Can't be perceived to play in these high intensity games. Emery, when he came in, said possession pressing was his
But Ramsey's not been starting in the starting
lineup. No, he's not starting. I know.
Either. There's nothing to suggest that like Ramsey's
key players in terms of what
Ozil and Ramsey are both. He's picking Iwobi and Mkhitaryan ahead of both of them at the moment.
Yeah,
that's another sort of. Maybe he doesn't want either of them.
Maybe he sees them as being like more system players.
Yeah. It's like I said, if you gave him the chance to keep Ramsey, I think he would absolutely do it. Yeah. But I don't think he's going to be broken up about it if he leaves.
Okay.
And probably this, you could argue the same with Ozil.
And they don't
need
either of them when they've got Lucas Torreira at the base of midfield.
Well,
Will's...
Hit him with the stats, Jake.
Will's detailed analysis of the Mesut Ozil situation may have taken us... beyond, but we have to mention Lucas Torreira because three out of their last four games, he's won Premier League Man of the Match, not just Arsenal's Man of the Match. He's been awarded Man of the Match award. He's now leading the team for recoveries. He made the most of the North London derby. He scored his first goal for the club, and the celebration that if Eric Dier endeared himself to Spurs fans immediately with that shush celebration, then Lucas Torreira whipping his shirt off and spinning it around. And it was like 5 minutes on the floor just celebrating that goal. He's now a fan favourite, and it looks like...
The only flaw with Lucas Torreira is that he's wearing the number 11 shirt. That's literally it. I graded him an A-plus signing when
asked. Because he wanted to stand next to Ozil in the dressing room.
Yeah, mate.
That's actually what he said.
Is it? Oh, yeah. Well, then fair enough. Now, look, this is the thing. Lucas Torreira is absolutely magnificent. When they signed him before Boris kicked, I graded him an A-plus signing. I couldn't believe Arsenal got him uncontested, considering like he basically walks into any Premier League side, literally any Premier League side, and arguably almost any side in the world as well. He's so, so, so good. And if Arsenal don't end up reaching the heights they want to reach under Unai Emery in 2 years or something, one of the big heavyweights is going to come in with like a 70, 80 million offer for this guy. He's absolutely phenomenal. He can do everything. And I mean, literally, he can play a disciplined holding role.
He
can be more of a box, not box to box midfielder, but he can go forward and attack. We saw it with the goal. Like he made a really good run forward, spanning behind was it Dier? Left him. Dier was like, where the hell am I? What's going on? And Torreira spanning behind him and finished it really well. And he takes great set pieces.
That goal has been coming, by the way, because watching Arsenal as well, you see those little tendencies to break forward.
Yeah,
and this is like a really hot take. But when you watch Lucas Torreira, when you see him tackle with his head and you see the tenacity and you see the ability to carry the ball and play everything nicely and look so composed, then that's like the Vieira midfielder that was gone. And then you look at his neat little touches, obviously his stature, his ability to play passes and these little slow break forwards. Then you've got that bit of Cazorla in there as well. And, and those arguably,
apart from
Fabregas in the middle of it,
I'll give you a better comparison.
He looks
like
a hybrid of both.
He looks like Roy Keane. That's what he looks like. He looks like Roy Keane. He's a brilliant tackling midfielder who can hold midfield, but also breaks forward very intelligently. Positionally, off the scale, knows exactly where to stand. Dogged, tenacious, loves playing football, loves to win, loves to score goals. Yeah, Lucas Torreira is the new Roy Keane. That's what he looks like to me. If you want to be a bit more contemporary, he's Javier Mascherano 10 years ago.
Mo's just served as the headline for this podcast plate there.
I can't speak highly enough of Lucas Torreira.
Passing the money under the table now for that one.
Absolutely spectacular. I can't get over how amazing he is.
It was a genuinely brilliant display, and he's done it now for a month, and it's like took his time. Arsenal haven't lost when he started a game.
They sensibly took their time introducing him.
Well, yeah,
he's played every game, right? But it's like always off the bench, like 5-10 minutes. You're like, and Emery played,
started 9 games, 1-6, drawn 3.
Emery played a blinder by introducing him slowly.
£26 million.
I mean,
signing of the season.
That looks like that's I would have to go along with that, because that is just by today's standards.
That's
incredibly cheap.
That's up there with Umtiti for 20 million quid as well. It's like one of those things, like,
relentless Barcelona references.
Umtiti,
who's injured.
Injured right now, yeah. Poor guy.
Cool. But anyway, waste of money.
It's just like, you know, it's how do you get those kind of deals in this current market?
It wasn't like an N'Golo Kanté signing from Angers, or was it Cannes?
No, he wasn't completely from obscurity.
So he wasn't like plucked from obscurity. We were talking about him before he joined.
Yeah,
he was at the World Cup having like...
Yeah.
I think maybe he signed it. Yeah. The deal was pretty much done.
He was top tackler In Syria, in the two seasons he was there.
That's what I thought was so strange, was that at the World Cup, it was very clear that this guy was absolutely amazing. And, like, forget every other club, right? Man United and Man City, both of whom, I mean, United signed Fred eventually, but it's like, the fact that they were like, ooh, hang on a minute, this guy, and didn't move for him, City.
Well, Liverpool went for Fabinho earlier as well.
I mean, yeah, Liverpool had their idea, and I think we'll talk about this later. I think they had the right idea.
That was my segue.
Because don't jump in straight in. We're doing Spurs. Bad result for them.
Yeah, well, we've spent 25 minutes on the North London derby, so I think just in general, Spurs obviously winning positions. They've dropped the most points. They've never beaten Man United and Arsenal away from home in a Premier League season, in the same Premier League season. They had the opportunity to do that, and they lost 4-2.
I just think it was a real sliding doors moment, because had they held on to this win, Eric Dier wouldn't have looked silly, and they would have just beaten Chelsea, Inter Milan and Arsenal in the space of a week. They would have been level with Liverpool on points at the full time whistle,
and now they're below Arsenal.
And now they're the losers of the game of the season, and essentially, I mean, that's kind of knocked them out of the title race a little bit as well.
It was very Spursy, and the thing is, I mean, Spurs, obviously you don't think of Spurs under Poch as being Spursy, but they've been quite Spursy in the Champions League, for example. I mean, they now need to go to Barcelona and win.
Perhaps Pochettino is plotting revenge already in advance by dropping into the Europa League and beating Arsenal. And Unai Emery is king of Europa League, so perhaps that is a bigger coup.
Just to beat him at his own game.
We'll give Pochettino credit for now.
London derby semi final.
That is a scheme.
That'd be tasty.
But the third derby of the day, and the second one we're going to speak about, obviously ended in dramatic fashion with forgotten man Divock Origi.
I mean, we talk about Spursy. How about Everton, mate? Good lord,
Evertony, sticky toffee.
I mean,
there's something there.
Toffee's
in a sticky situation.
Should we pause recording and just really like spitball a few sort of, you know, negatives?
And you'll never know if we did or not. but yeah, Pickford, basically, the ball was going out of play and he put it back in.
It's one of those ones that the ball had spin on it, right? So it's one of those, when you look at goalkeepers, and then so many times you watch a goalkeeper just sort of prod a ball over, you're like, that ball was going over, why didn't you just leave it, goalkeeper? And it's because, this is why, because if you try and catch it, or if you leave it or try and catch it, you might mess up and it might hit the bar and bounce back into play. So this is why keepers always do that little thing where they dunk a ball over the bar. It looks like pointless and needless, but it's safety first. Pickford was for some reason terrified of a conceding a corner, even though they've got Yerry Mina, they just brought Kurt Zouma on the field, they've got these brilliant aerial defenders.
That's the first goal they've conceded with Yerry Mina on the pitch.
I mean, it was so strange. It's like, why would you do that? You've got the guys who can. Liverpool are good at set pieces, right? Let's be fair, they're very good at it, and Everton historically aren't necessarily, but like, they've got Yerry Mina's there. And, you know,
what he's like.
Brought Kurt Zouma on. Exactly. And it's just like, why don't you have confidence in your players, Jordan Pickford? He panicked.
I
think he was just... That was just a freak situation.
Yeah. It's a weird thing because you don't expect that from him.
Goalkeepers make mistakes.
He's not committed a card.
They make mistakes. And when they do, Pickford does interviews with the Daily Mail calling them out for it.
I was going to say, if Eric Dier was one of the losers of the weekend for being instantly made to be forgotten.
He does have my sympathy for that, but he has a little bit less of my sympathy because of his previous comments.
It's a bit.
Although, actually, to defend him there, he said, "You'll never see me making blunders like Alisson."
Yeah, his
regards to Cruyff turns.
Yeah,
which he did for England and nearly gave away a penalty. So now he's covered every base of making mistakes.
And also in the Croatia game when he sort of barreled out of goal and chested it down outside the area, that was pretty dumb.
The funniest thing was...
I don't know why he doesn't just embrace the sort of, you know...
Yeah. Like, the funny thing
about... He's a good goalkeeper. His one weakness is coming for crosses because he's a small goalkeeper.
Because all of the best ones are at the moment.
I mean, look, this is the thing. Pickford... the funniest thing, of course, was that him and Alisson were brilliant. Alisson was brilliant all game. Pickford was brilliant until the 94th minute. 96th even, sorry. And, you know, so they were actually...
After only 5 minutes were awarded.
You know, they both played really well. They are the reason it was 0-0 going into the 96th minute, because Sadio Mane should have scored when he had that chance, but Pickford pulled out a great save.
I mean, that should have been like 3-3.
Exactly.
Yerry Mina should have scored.
It's a combination of bad goalkeeping, bad defending, and just good, you know.
Well, this is the thing. So Liverpool won, and obviously Everton in the 21st century haven't won a Premier League game at Anfield still. Yeah. Like, it's really bad. But was Klopp's celebration and thoughts on that in itself, but was that a sign of how well Everton played and how well they competed? And it was Andre Gomez, another midfield signing, that really sort of... He made his debut in October.
Because it wasn't just relief, it was... surprise almost. It was shock. Like, oh my God, I can't believe we've got a win out of this game given how it's panned out.
Yeah, I mean, that's... I mean, you look at it...
Because when you steam onto the pit, like... we've beaten Everton. It was like, he was genuinely happy with beating Everton. And I don't think you feel that emotional unless the game that has been played for that long was tightly contested.
Maybe not from his point of view, but for supporters, that's a better way to win a derby than a 5-2 thrashing, basically.
Not better than a 4-2.
Potentially.
That's it's the age old thing, isn't it? Would you rather beat them 5-0? Would you rather win 1-0 in the last minute with a really jammy goal? They're both different.
Liverpool did likewise a couple of seasons ago with Sadio Mane scoring like the 94th. Yeah.
Everton, Liverpool have scored more stoppage time winners against Everton than any club has scored against any other, with five now.
It's one of those things, isn't it? It's the Everton thing. It just seems so weird because Everton was so good. Andre Gomez was the best midfielder on the park. If you told me that a year ago, he'd be the best midfielder on the park in the Merseyside derby with Naby Keita, Fabinho, and I'd be like, are you kidding?
Well, you wouldn't have known any of them were going to be playing.
I don't think he actually plays for Everton.
But my point is, if you told me, you said there was a match and Andre Gomez was playing against Naby Keita, Fabinho, and he was going to be the best midfielder, I'd be like, no.
That makes more sense.
But he was, and he was great. And
good job, good hosting there. Yeah.
And they played very well.
Steering you in the right direction. Direction.
Clarify your meaning. Yeah.
You know, they played so well. They played so boldly. They weren't. Richarlison was incredible.
Oh, like, I love Richarlison.
He was, but he also should have done better when he was sort of slalomed through in the first half.
Yeah, yeah. There was a chance where
he was doing a bit more defending than he was attacking.
He's defending that moment right at the end when he pitched the ball off. I can't remember. Was the edge of his own box? I was like, wow.
Did he out Firmino?
I mean,
100%. Yeah, definitely based on that.
I'm now fully on board that Richarlison should be replaced Luis Suarez at Barcelona hype train now. That's confirmed with that game.
He has your seal of approval.
The train that you built and no one else is on yet.
That's a reversal of the traditional well-trodden Barcelona to Everton transfer path. They must have a bit of goodwill in the bank from all the players.
Have all our players.
Or maybe they'll swap him for Gomez, who they should definitely sign permanently.
I mean, absolutely. This is what I've said about Andre Gomez, just to briefly go on him, is that this is his level. It was really nice, the idea that he could succeed at Barcelona, but it's just playing for a club where he bravely spoken out about the pressure of playing for Barcelona, and it got to him and it was too much, and it was, because skill set wise Gomez was perfect for Barcelona. There's literally nothing he can't do on a football field: tackle, defend,
so
dribble,
a jack of all trades.
But it's just mentally he could never put it all together for Barcelona, and it was and that's a real shame. But it's like, this is Everton, is this what Everton want to be? Top six club, then be top four. That's his level, where this upper mid table club where the fans love him and support him and he plays every single game and he's the hub of the midfield. That's perfect for him. I think he's going to do really, really well. And I mean, he's done well obviously, but he's going to continue.
If Torreira was the midfielder that Arsenal was so desperate for, and Andre Gomez is pretty much the same for Everton,
Arteta, isn't it? The Arteta comparisons are there.
Yeah, Arteta comparisons as well. And the stat that I quite liked was that since he made his debut, he's completed more take-ons than any central midfielder. And it's that idea of being his passing first and foremost, progressing it with the ball, but having that ability to carry it and just get Everton forward. Because before they've had Idrissa Gueye, one of the best in the league at what he does, which is get the ball back and give it to someone else. But they've never had the someone else. Like Tom Davies at 20 years, Tom Davies is still 20, 21 years old.
He's a runner though, as well.
He played off quite frequently in centre midfield. I think he's a bit more box to box. I agree.
He's got that one plot, but the progressive passing was perhaps missing.
I agree. I think it's like just one of the most well balanced sort of. It's not really a midfield trio, of course. It's more of a double pivot with a ten. I'd like to see a midfield trio. But that trio is just. I know it's probably not the best, but it's on paper the most pleasing, because those three players have very, very obvious strengths, and they're all different.
There's no overlap.
They complement each other very, very nicely.
But
speaking of Firmino, as you brought him up.
I was going to say, on the other side, you had...
Let him do his segue.
Yeah. On the other side, though, you had... Well, we mentioned Firmino briefly, and it's like Jamie Carragher was seemingly wanting to be taking him off, and he's not scoring, but he's playing a different role. So that's something in itself. But Liverpool also had a new midfielder playing in their team.
They did.
And Fabinho started, and he won the most tackles, which he did when he made his debut, or not his full debut against Red Star. Like, there's a theme here. When Fabinho plays, he's winning the ball a lot. And again, what did Liverpool not have?
I agree, but his performance in that game was hugely divisive from what I saw. I personally don't think he was that great. He looked really leggy. And in the first half, certainly, it looked like the occasion got to him and he was going in for slide tackles a bit too much. I see him as obviously it gets the fans up, but I mean he's also giving away fouls through slide tackles, so I mean that's not really what you want. I see him as being a bit and that's not really what you want to see from Fabinho, because he seems a bit more of a classy screener of the defence, and I know he does make a lot of tackles, but you want to see him make cuter tackles,
stand up tackles
where you're overturning. You don't want to see him being blood and thunder snapping into tackles.
I think recoveries is my new favourite thing. I was reading the definitions and stuff, and it's like it's almost as good as a tackle, but it implies more sort of awareness of the play. Like it's tackle as
it's like you're scooping the ball
as
up,
that famous sort of the famous quote. I'm not even sure if it's real. The Maldini one about if I have to make a tackle,
I've already
made a mistake. Whereas a recovery is where a player recovers the ball in a situation where neither team has possession or where the ball has been played directly to him by an opponent. So it's just securing possession for the team. And if you're top that shows that you're just always in the right place.
Yeah, Fabinho has obvious qualities. I've banged on about it for ages. He has obvious qualities. And the reason why Liverpool signed him makes so much sense. He's kind of perfect for what they need, but he's not fully adapted yet, whether that's because Klopp has been almost overly patient with him.
Had as much game time as perhaps Lucas Torreira and Andre Gomez, I would say. So coming back to this idea that he was quite divisive in his performance, why is Andre Gomez being awarded man of the match by most outlets? I know the BBC did. I think Sky might have done as well. Why is he winning man of the match if Fabinho has been impressive in that display? That shouldn't be the case. And I think the other issue is
perhaps Gomez was just more impressive.
But that's a midfield battle that he's won. So Fabinho's lost the midfield battle there, basically.
Well, how did was Liverpool win? They were in their 4-2-3-1 again.
Yeah, exactly. This is the other thing I was going to say is that and Fabinho's in a sense, and Shaqiri as well, because Shaqiri plays in that number two, is being accommodated by Klopp's switch to a 4-2-3-1. Mm-hmm. That also entails Firmino dropping back. Behind Salah in the number 10 position, where he has been awful this season. Carragher was saying that he looks like a new signing adapting to life in the Premier League.
This is the thing though, isn't it? Firmino, when he signed, he played a lot of 10, didn't he? And it was sort of like, he didn't look at, he really took off when he started playing 9, didn't he? In this fluid front three, I think.
It's Firmino.
Yeah, Firmino. Sorry.
Well, yeah, and also, so he wasn't good in that initial position, and also I think he's currently on his worst goal scoring drought in Premier League career so far.
He's struggling to. I think two things. His first thing is expectation of production. After last season, he was absolutely brilliant. Klopp's banging on. There's only one player that's always world class. It's Firmino.
Exactly. So that's consistency.
And he was excellent. He was flawless last season. Almost flawless. But since Vertonghen went knuckle deep in him, he's not really been a.
Well, he scored the winner against Paris.
Yeah, but that was it though. See, after that little burst of has he been? I mean, obviously, I'm not saying Vertonghen jabbing him in the eye intentionally was the reason, but it's
Firmino isn't good anymore because he can't see.
That was the last time I remember him being like, oh,
he's
Firmino.
He's got a depth perception.
You know, it does seem like, I think part of it is because the way he played 9, it wasn't so much a false 9, but he had so much movement, freedom of movement horizontally and vertically. When you're playing a 10 with a striker ahead of you, even if that striker's Mohamed Salah, who drifts wide anyway, it ultimately limits what you can do.
I think you've hit the nail on the head.
I think Firmino doesn't really work in a constrained sort of position with two wide guys beside him and one guy ahead of him. The reason he works so well with Mane and Salah last season is because all three of them could essentially play all three positions on the, and it was he moving on the movement constantly, and when Firmino's on the move, he's absolutely exceptional, and it's there's very few players who can live with him in terms of like strikers out there that are as good. But when you can't try and constrain him as a number 10, has to be automatically constrained. I think that's the real issue. I think, like you said, the 4-2-3-1, obviously he's trying to accommodate the fact that he's got Shaqiri, who's very good, and it obviously it does help ease Fabinho in because he's more familiar with the 4-2-3-1.
But Klopp said at the beginning of the season that Fabinho is better in a two.
Yeah, he said he was comparing a Keita with Fabinho and said that RB liked his style of play. Obviously, that's Keita's former team. Is more similar, so he should adapt more quickly.
Yeah.
And he probably did, because you're looking at that first performance against West Ham, it looked like he had a potential to sign the season. He's dropped off hugely and he's had injury problems. So obviously that's not come about. He's not adapted quite so quickly as you would have hoped. But when he was talking about Fabinho, he said Monaco, completely different style of play.
And the funny thing is, though, they both technically did play two in midfield. Leipzig were just very
On paper, it was like that should work.
It's just funny how they both technically played in a 4-4-2 in their best periods at their previous clubs.
Yeah.
It was usually a 4-4-2. Completely opposite.
I always think constraining Firmino to that position, as Mo says, just makes him too predictable. And is that a cost worth paying to accommodate Firmino?
They're unbeaten in the league, and
so, I mean, I know. The tone of this analysis has always been sort of doom and gloom.
That's the point, though. When Firmino is playing the best football of his career, Liverpool came fourth, got to a Champions League final. Firmino is being more reserved, playing as a 10, trying to supplement others. Liverpool haven't lost a game.
It's one of those things. What's better to be, slow and explosive and fun and all that stuff, or maybe to be a little bit less explosive, a little bit less fun, and a bit more consistent. And what's better?
If they were the hare last season, they'd be in the tortoise.
I mean, it's
this season.
No, but they were tortoise behind a turbocharged rabbit,
a tortoise hair hybrid child,
a turbocharged rabbit hair that just has no intention of having a nap, basically.
They're a tortoise behind the Duracell bunny.
We should say the hair is Man City in this analogy,
in case you weren't on our wavelength.
In case your fable knowledge wasn't quite up to scratch.
They're a tortoise behind the Duracell bunny. That bunny's not going to slow down.
Who didn't buy a midfielder?
Who didn't? And I still think they need
but
to at some
guess
point.
Who turned up and started playing in midfield? Bernardo Silva.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, that's...
Man City, we speak enough about them. Raheem Sterling, again, is now... that Aubameyang scored. He was battling for the Playmaker Award, which is obviously actually a thing now.
Raheem Sterling's very good. That's basically it.
But on the other side of Manchester, and this is a good team to actually talk about this week. I know we do a lot, but obviously Arsenal-Man United now... It's a massive game in itself. Arsenal can go on 20 games unbeaten for the first time in 11 years if they do not lose at Old Trafford.
Arsenal unbeaten runs Old Trafford, you think, it's only going to end one way. But then at the same time, if you watched United play at the weekend, oh my God.
Hold fire on your prediction there, my friend.
But Mourinho's quotes about it, the theme of this podcast that we've tried to communicate is the midfielders, teams that have, their midfield signings have gone well, are looking really impressive.
Yep.
Fred is not there anymore. And Mourinho said that the reason they drew to Southampton 2-2, who have just sacked their manager after getting a 2-2 draw, that's more an indictment of Man United.
Yeah.
It's like, you drew 2-2 to Man United, that doesn't actually matter anymore.
Unacceptable.
Yeah. Considering they were 2-0 up, it probably was unacceptable as well. But Mourinho said... absolute inability to have any intensity in the midfield was the reason for the defeat.
Yeah,
simplicity is genius, he said. And given, I don't want to put words in his mouth, but you believe that there are certain players that
do not adhere
to that as often.
There's rumours around that he called Pogba virus after the match, which I totally believe, because that sounds exactly like something he'd say, because he said that before about Eden Hazard, about John Terry, about Iker Casillas.
Is it that same term or was it slightly different?
The thing was in the locker room afterwards, he called him a virus, said he doesn't put in the effort and doesn't try. I mean, it's allegedly. I don't know if it's accurate or not.
It's an awful thing to say.
It does sound.
It was Duncan Castles, wasn't it, that sort of broke that. And he's He's famous for being...
And that does sound exactly like something Jose
Mourinho. Yeah.
It sounds exactly like something Mourinho would say because he said it before. It's very clearly... If she told me that was true, I wouldn't really have a hard time believing it. Look, Pogba was rubbish. Let's be honest.
He was
absolutely terrible, and he deserved to be criticised for that. But this is a growing trend where when Paul Pogba plays poorly, everyone jumps on him, and deservedly so when he plays poorly. But it's this sort of thing where how many players are actually playing well under Jose Mourinho? Like Martial's had this recent run, which has been great.
He was dropped,
but he was dropped.
I think Mourinho's point.
After two scoreless games, he got dropped, and it's like. Huh? And you know he played Rashford and Lukaku up front of two, and it was like, oh, okay. And then Lukaku was demonstrably worse than Rashford, and he took Lukaku off in the end as well. But it's just
I think Rashford asked to be replaced.
Did he?
Yeah, that's what Mourinho said after the game, I believe. And also because Rashford was referred to in these mad dog comments. It was Mourinho singled out two players who he did fit his description of mad dogs.
He didn't pick them out for being a mad dog. He said they showed the like fight and...
Was it immediately after? Or immediately
he was just listing loads of really interesting stuff.
Well, anyway, he did refer to Rashford and he did refer to Jones. And obviously Rashford's work rate was there to see.
But there's no consistency to it. That's the thing. It's like, you know, what was it at the week? And midweek he's like, oh, look at Rashford. Look what he had to do it up with after his miss. It's just, he's just ridiculous. There's no consistency to what he does. It's like one minute he's like, Rashford, oh my God, he's so terrible. One minute he's like, I love Rashford, loads of fire. And, you know, Pogba gave him the captain's armband, then he drops him. I mean, it wouldn't surprise me if Pogba doesn't even play against Arsenal, to be honest. Mourinho needs to go. He's prehistoric. He's just an absolute joke.
If he needs to go, though, and they need to replace him so desperately, what candidates actually are there to bring in now?
Pablo Machin. Pay whatever Sevilla need, get him. He's absolutely magic. His best formation, 3-5-2, fits exactly with what Man United have in their squad right now. They've got strikers, they've got no wingers, and they've got fullbacks who can't really defend, so just making wingbacks.
They haven't got any centre backs. They played three at the back against Southampton. And Matic played. Yeah, and but got spun by Nathan
but
Redmond.
That's just because Mourinho's weird. You know, you've got.
Yeah, but who do they play? If three at the back. That's
Smalling,
not really
Smalling, Lindelof,
injured,
and then
they don't have the depth.
How injured are they? If they're out for a long time, then fine. But you know what? I'm sure there are young players you can get. I'm sure you can recall Axel Tuanzebe, maybe. There's Marcus Rojo who's getting fit again. There's options to play. But 3-5-2, you look at it, solves pretty much all of United's problems. Except obviously their centre backs aren't great apart from Lindelof and Bailey. But that's two out of three, and that's pretty good. And you have to figure, I would imagine, all the little problems that are currently ailing Eric Bailey, quote-unquote, will miraculously go away once Mourinho leaves the club, I would imagine, as well. So there's talent there to play, and there's great midfielders. There's fantastic forwards. You unleash all of that. Fred, Pogba, Lingard in the midfield three. You know, you've got Dallow and Shaw or Young out wide. They're not great options out wide, but their job is just to run up and down. They can do that plenty. Ashley Young, we saw in the World Cup, can do that. Machin has worked wonders with Sevilla, right? Absolutely worked wonders. They are a beautiful side to watch. They're really good. They're really relentless. They're one point off the top in La Liga. You know, and that's on a budget of basically not even comparable to what even the bottom Premier League club
has. I don't even have Monchi anymore. Yeah.
Exactly, and they can do that. You give him Man United's budget, even with their haphazard transfer activities, he would do so many.
Yeah, but that's
so
what I mean.
So to say, I think Lindelof comes back is expected to figure at some point during the Christmas period. But I think the question of who do you replace Jose Mourinho with is made 10 times more complicated by the fact that, I mean, there have been reports at different stages over the season that they're considering appointing a sporting director. And I think that needs to come first. So I think they need to kind of go behind Mourinho's back, really. So initially in August, you had reports, I think from The Independent, saying they're about to embark on their quest to find the new sporting director. Monchi was one of the names mentioned. Another one was a Juventus sporting director, whose name I forget. And then there, a couple of months down the line, there were reports from the Mail saying that was on hold and that they won't be appointing one until Mourinho is gone. That doesn't make sense to me. I think they do need to be sort of actively pursuing this appointment of a sporting director, because they need to get that in place before they make their next managerial appointment, which they need to get right. And judging by what Raphael Honigstein wrote in his book on Jurgen Klopp about Ed Woodward, describing Manchester United as the adult version of Disneyland, to Jurgen Klopp in their pitch to get him to manage them. I think he needs to be nowhere near
appointment. He's good at getting tractor sponsorship.
He needs to be nowhere near the appointment of their next manager. So they get the sporting director in first and they can establish a strategy. They identify their prime candidate and then just accept no other. There needs to be no scattergun approach.
You've just described Arsenal's process.
Well, I mean, they went through quite a few candidates. So, I mean, they have
this
to do
it. This is what I mean, but what they got in
process.
First in January, they got in Sven Mislintat, head of recruitment,
so,
and they got all the negotiators. Gazidis was obviously clearly leaving. The plan was there, and then it was all sort of unravelled in the summer. Yeah. It was like, oh.
They need to follow. They need to follow Arsenal's blueprint, is basically what I'm saying.
Yeah.
So they need to get the sporting director who can establish a strategy revolving around their prime candidate to take over the club. Because if any club in English, if not the world, can get their ideal candidate as manager, it's got to be Manchester United.
I do worry that the talk is about Zinedine Zidane, because what people need to realise about Zidane, if they pay attention to Real Madrid, is that he didn't come in and do so many tactical revolutions. He came in tactically and he copied what Carlo Ancelotti did when they won La Decima, and his great thing was motivation, which is fine.
That's what Mourinho always moans about, though.
Yeah, but I mean, if you've got literally the best players in the world, that's fine. You have great fullbacks, that's fine, because Madrid's fullbacks took care of so much work for Zidane, and you're not going to have rubbish fullbacks.
I'd also just highlight the fact that you've said, like, Man United have all of this wonderful talent.
Yeah, yeah.
To use.
Yeah, but they also have key weaknesses in areas where I don't know if Zidane's a brilliant motivational technique.
But then I'd also say, if Zidane can get the best out of Pogba, Martial, Lukaku, and Rashford, then you're terrifying.
Yeah, that's that's also true. That's also true. But I just think if you look at Zidane, the one thing they relied on heavily for creativity and for impact in the final third was the fullbacks, and United's fullbacks are garbage. Luke Shaw's lovely, but Luke Shaw gets injured every 5 minutes, and it's clearly he can't stay fit for more than five games in a row. It's really sad. But even now, when he's made all these commitments to change and everything, he still can't stay fit. He got injured again. He's wonderful when he's fit, but he's clearly not just one of those players who's never going to be fit.
It's all sort of, that's a whole podcast on Zidane taking charge of Man United. Another person that is available technically is Jardine, who has been mentioned.
That would be quite astute.
Obviously a compatriot of Mourinho as well. Did well at Monaco, with good talent recruitment, not necessarily...
He was really hamstrung by them selling his best players, essentially, like decimating a lineup that won the title and got to the Champions League semi-finals, I believe. It'd be interesting to see what he does. However, he does come in on the back of like a pretty awful start to the season.
Yeah, but if you look at how Henry's gone, I think that Monaco situation, the fact that you're having to play 2001-born players in the Champions League...
Their squad got absolutely...
They've been decimated by sales, and then... injuries have just plagued the whole... that Monaco team, I don't think that reflected well on Jardim's ability, and I don't think it reflects well on Henry's either.
No, it doesn't. I've always said that Henry should have waited to the end of the season to take that job, because that squad needs work and it needs...
And as well, with Monaco, when they got to the semi-final, played like a nice little 4-4-2, which in classic romance about Manchester United and the glory years is what they excelled at. So I've always thought that sort of marries up quite well, but Man United need... They don't just need a manager, they need that whole...
Marcus Rashford is Kylian Mbappe light. Yeah. You know,
the last thing I read was something like they were after Atletico Madrid's Andrea Berta, and I think the sort of... But those might be sort of tenuous reports.
A sporting director is good, and then obviously a manager. They need to move now, because I've said this before.
I just think it has to come first, because I think you could almost write this season off and see what Jose Mourinho can do in the Champions League.
There's nothing he can do in the Champions. If you watch them against...
Well, I mean, they're through. They're in the knockout.
Yeah, but again...
Last 16, I need to get past that. But quarter final, I can win
exactly.
it.
Like, he... Yeah.
But yeah, credit to Mourinho.
He's won the Europa League.
I come across as a critic of Mourinho because I don't necessarily think the way that he plays is beneficial for like a development of a team. But he's a very good tournament manager.
He is.
That's why I think his next job should just be in international football, because he'd do very well.
He is, but I just think if you look at the way they're played in the Champions League, even the Champions League where they've had this quote-unquote success, any good team will destroy
them. Juventus battered them and they won. What I mean is the Champions League, as we've seen for the last few seasons, is very...
He can stumble
his way into a final.
Yeah, you could fluke it if you have a lucky draw like Madrid did 2 years.
And if he does that, imagine...
There's also there's an argument that they should almost hope Spurs win a trophy this season, so that then Pochettino can say, it's time to go now. I've done as much as I can do with the Spurs team. And then...
God, imagine that.
He's the ultimate. It'd be so interesting to see what he could do with a bit of money.
Oh, yeah.
He might turn out that he's absolutely rubbish at making signings.
I think if that Spurs trophy stuff does happen, then it's straight to the Bernabeu.
It's the Bernabeu. It's not.
Manchester United should be throwing their hat in the ring.
Yeah, yeah.
Because you've got a Premier League proven manager there as well.
But Pochettino's not in charge at the moment. And on Wednesday, the team he just lost against anyway, Arsenal, go to Old Trafford. What is the score going to be?
4-1 to Arsenal.
Oh my word, that's bold. Everyone make a note of that.
Either 0-0 or 4-1 to Arsenal. It's one of the two. It's not going to be anything else in between.
At Old Trafford.
Yeah. United are terrible.
I need revenge for that 8-2.
United are absolutely terrible. Arsenal are incredible. They're flying. It's either going to be, like I said, it's every chance Mourinho's going to grind out for a 0-0 because that's just what Mourinho does. But If Arsenal went there,
he's not really done that.
They've got a bad defense this season. Yeah. They're not grinding out any.
If Arsenal went there and slapped the taste out of United's mouth, it wouldn't surprise me. 4-1, absolutely.
Will 4-1 agree?
No, 2-2. I think that Man United's best stuff has come in big games this season, and I think. I mean, the reason the London derby was so good was because neither team had control of it. It was in the hands of the football gods, as all good derbies should be. But I think Jose Mourinho will be able to impose a level of control on this home game that Pochettino wasn't able to. And I think that's going to result in 2-2 from my prediction.
See,
I don't think he's got enough in the tank to end Arsenal's unbeaten run. But I think. I think it might be like a win too far for Arsenal.
I just think
Spurs that and Man United.
If you actually think so, big, what is it? Two or what?
I mean, if Arsenal
2-0 at Stamford Bridge, but they lost 3-0 to Spurs at Old Trafford.
Yeah,
didn't they? Yeah. Your one point. I don't necessarily disagree with the scoreline because I.
Well, it's a game of opinion.
I'm just saying. I don't necessarily with that, but I wouldn't. Yeah. I don't believe for a second that Man United will control that game. I just think there's going to be Mourinho hoodoo over Arsenal.
They did for certain portions against Chelsea. So.
And they started really well against Spurs and they lost 3-0. For me, it's so difficult to call that because there's like
and it's
so
Old Trafford,
many intangibles.
And it's Arsenal.
Yeah,
and it's
exactly.
But if Arsenal win this though, how many points off Liverpool are they already?
Well, because they're fourth, aren't they? They're above Spurs on goal difference.
The
Gunners are going to fire Manchester United into the sun.
There we go.
That's not Mo's just trying to get Mo's headlines
preparing
in.
That off air.
Yeah. he was staring into the mirror.
My actual off air comments can't be heard on the family podcast.
I was going to prompt you to when you didn't say
many bleeps needed for that one. But obviously, the festive fixtures. So we're going 4-1 and we've got a 2-2.
Yeah.
I'm abstaining.
What? Just picked half my prediction.
I don't necessarily agree. Because if I say Arsenal will win, then I'm going to curse it.
You always do this. I don't know why you don't get involved. You always abstain from predictions.
Yeah, because in my head, that Arsenal should win 2 or 3-1.
So you're saying 3-1 Arsenal?
I just don't think it's going to happen. So you just take that as you will.
Right, so I think I know why you're doing this. Based on logic and reason, you predict Arsenal to win, but you don't want to curse it. You want to jinx it.
That's literally what I just explained. So I'm not explicitly saying
my
prediction.
I understand. So does that mean you're going to predict the other two games in this?
Yeah, session? I will. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
So, the other two we've got written down is the unique derby of Brighton Crystal Palace. Crystal Palace just mustered the most shots they've ever managed under Hodgson against a Burnley team. Who again said that shots don't matter?
Yeah.
Their manager.
Shots
they
matter. Shots matter, Sean.
So Crystal Palace look all right.
I think
sort of.
I think look, they got a win. I think they don't want to say turn a corner, but I would back Palace in this game. I think Brighton are kind of all over the place right now. You look at after winning those three games 1-0, they just sort of gone a bit topsy turvy. I think Palace.
Did they beat Huddersfield the weekend?
They got Brighton.
Because Mounier got sent off.
I think it was 2-1. I think it was Palace have been better than their recent record in terms of results suggests.
Well, they were very good against Arsenal and Man United.
And they're going to be desperate to start hoovering up points now because they've been kind of dragged into the bottom reach of the table by that horrendous recent run of fixtures, which involved games against like Everton, Manchester United, Arsenal, Spurs and Chelsea. So they're going to be quite eager to get the points. Yeah. However, they come up against a Brighton side that are actually quite good at home. They've conceded just one goal in their last four games and they've, I think they've pretty much... I think they're either unbeaten or they've won all their past four home games at the Amex.
Internet's not working, so I can't fact check your...
everything I've just said.
I'm kidding. Or confirm
so,
it.
I don't see Palace winning, but I think it's going to be a cagey 0-0.
I think Palace will win, but
with two teams with a fair bit to lose in terms of momentum and they'll both be like quite eager for the points.
What was yours, mate?
I think Palace will win, but Glenn Murray will score 2-1.
So I think 1-1 on that one. I sort of lean towards Will's points, but I also like how many chances that Zaha Townsend front two doesn't make any sense.
You like Palace's chances, basically, literally.
I do. Yeah, that's a good way to put it. The next prediction that we've got on here is Watford versus Man City.
Easy money for City.
This is perfect time, although it's not this month that he won it. You don't want to win Premier League Manager of the Month this season.
Because this month?
But this season.
Oh, right.
Every manager that's won it, and again, the internet's not working, so I can't get the stats up. But Javi Gracia obviously got his new contract, and Watford have actually stumbled a bit. They made that incredible start to the season. So I think they're going to get absolutely battered. I went to Man City beating Watford 6-0 at Vicarage Road last season it was. And I can see the same thing happening.
It looks like they'll be without Etienne Capoue as well. I know they were appealing his red card for the tackle on Iheanacho at the weekend. But as it stands, he's down as suspended on the FA's website.
I
can see them just getting overrun in midfield.
Yeah, I think 5-0.
I was going to say 5-1. I think
City will concede, but I think I was going to go for 3-1.
So this little Premier League Manager of the Month nugget. In August, Javi Gracia won it with 3 wins and then win, lose, draw, lose. In September, Wolves won it, win, win, draw, win, and then win, lose, lose in the next month. And then Eddie Howe won it in October, November, 3 L's on the trot.
3 L's.
So I'm praying that Arsenal have one little draw so Emery, the master tactician, does not get it.
Yeah.
So that we can continue this unbeaten run.
I think he's a good candidate.
November though.
It's unfortunate
November
that game
great.
Fell on the
no,
second
it's,
of December.
It's very fortunate because he got a couple of draws in November, so he won't be in the running for that. But December could be.
Oh, I see what you mean.
December starting with a North London derby win though, he's in pole position to take the award this month. But there's so much football to play, but there's no more time to speak about it. So for this week, I want to thank my guests once again. Mo, thank you for coming on.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure as always.
And Will, thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Until next time, guys.